whenever you're sending an email to a journalist or an influencer or anybody who you want to build a relationship with, first of all, read it out loud. And when you read it out loud, imagine yourself standing in front of that person. Would you say that out loud to that person? That's the question you want to ask. If it is, then yes, great, send it along. If it's something that you kind of, well, maybe not, if there is a maybe in there, time to rewrite that email.
Hello and welcome to the Jumpstart Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Sauer. Today, for our 92nd episode, we're going to talk with Dmitry Dragilev, who is founder of Just Reach Out, which currently helps 4,000 plus entrepreneurs get featured in press on autopilot every single day. Now, I have to admit, I'm one of those people who is scared of public relations. Not because I don't think it's useful. I think it's a fantastic way to grow an audience and a presence beyond channels like SEO or Facebook. But it just seems to be such a precise set of skills that are needed to succeed with a PR strategy. And I don't actually have those skills. And that's why I was excited when a listener and a friend of the podcast named Scott connected me with Dmitry for a potential interview. While we have had PR pros on the podcast in the past, like Lisa Grimm from Whole Foods, I was interested in hearing specific strategies for getting press mentions, like what Dmitry has been able to do throughout his career. You see, I'm a customer of Dmitry's software called Just Reach Out, and I've been following his story for years. It seemed like a great tale to share on the podcast. But it wasn't just Dmitry's story that I was interested in. I wanted to provide you with some actionable tips for your own outreach strategies. And Dmitry delivered the goods. I really enjoyed hearing Dmitry's backstory, his source of inspiration, how he turned PR into a two-headed business, and the actionable tips that we can all utilize right away after listening to this podcast. I think you're going to enjoy this one. Let's get to our talk with Dmitry Dragilev. For show notes, visit jefflytics.com/Dmitry. Okay, we're here today with Dmitry Dragilev. Dmitry, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. And I've watched some of your videos and I'm familiar with what you do, but I don't think my audience is. And we haven't really talked much PR. So I really am looking forward to getting to hear your story. And let's start with the question we ask everybody when we start off. And that is, what was the first project or breakthrough you had that got you into this wild world of digital marketing?
I was a software engineer at BAE Systems, which I think they have an office in UK or an arm in UK, but it's a defense contractor. And I was doing really well. I was young. I was earning tons of money, except I was not excited at work. I was reading this Web 2.0 magazine. And I think that was the reason. Like, there's this crappy little Web 2.0 magazine that I was getting. And this Web 2.0 magazine was talking about, this was 2005, 2006, was talking about these startups in Silicon Valley raising money. And I was thinking, these kids are like younger than me. And they've raised millions of dollars and they are building some products and they are living the life that I want. And I'm going every day to a job where I have a security clearance and I have a government witness assigned to me. And while I'm developing cool tools for the military or the Air Force to use, and it's exciting, it's still kind of mundane and boring and too much bureaucracy. There's got to be better ways to spend your time. I wanted to be excited every single moment of my work day, and I was not. So quit my job, and at the time, my girlfriend, now my wife, wanted to go to California because she wanted to apply to, she applied and got into a graduate program. So I moved with her, and we moved to California. And we sold everything we had. I quit my job, just had some savings, and I moved out to California because this was near Silicon Valley, and I wanted to be one of those startups, like work with one of those startups, but I didn't know how to do marketing at all. I had no formal training. I didn't know anything about it. I read some articles about it at the time, and I got a book, and I don't know, like I started reading some Seth Godin books. I think I looked at his blog a couple of times. This was 2007, 2006. And I got into an MBA program. Actually, the very first 2 weeks, I just made it my job to try and find a startup to work at for free. And I found one through the alumni at my MBA program in the first 2 weeks. And I started working there, and it was a wild ride. In 2 years, we raised $6 million and $3 million and $9 million in the first 2 years. Scaled from nothing to almost 5 million users and built a team from maybe 3 to 4 or 25 or so. And then I had left the company to work for another one. This one got acquired. And that was my genesis in the marketing career, really.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's really cool. I mean, it seems like that was a weird time back then too, because it was when things were starting to turn around for Web 2.0. But not fully. And so did you know that this was like, was it sort of like, we look at Silicon Valley right now as like, it's almost like a sure thing at some point that these startups are going to become strong and there's these unicorns and stuff like that. Was that the picture that you were facing when you went out there, or was it much more of a leap of faith when you went out there in 2006, 2007?
There were certainly some unicorns. None of them were public yet, I don't think. And this was right before financial crisis. So what I saw is just people are really excited about what they were doing, really young, and getting paid more than me. And I was thinking, wow, it can't be. Like, I thought I had it made with this job. And I was thinking, and they're living in California. There's amazing weather. So everything together as a package had me sold. I didn't know how to, you know, I sold everything I had. And we just moved there with my Honda Civic. We drove cross country and we didn't have anything. So we tried to find an apartment for a while.
That's cool. Yeah. So when you went there and you got the job or whatever, what was your role there? Was it PR or was it software engineering?
My first job was a free intern. So essentially, I pitched myself as a marketing intern. The founder said I had no marketing experience, which he was completely right. And so he gave me a test. He said, we are a new company and we need to put up a Wikipedia page. Why don't you put up a Wikipedia page? This was September 2007. And I said, why not? I didn't know anything about it. So I put up a CrossLoop Wikipedia page. That was the name of the company, CrossLoop. And the minute I put it up, I got attacked by all the editors on there saying, this is blatant self-promotion. This is going to be taken down immediately. So I started defending myself saying, you know, the founder is from LinkedIn and this is a new venture and we have these investors on board and he's been covered in press before. And so he just watched the way I interacted with them, and I guess he liked me taking a few stabs to defend myself. Or I kept the page up, and you know, it's still up there now, all these years, 10 years now. It was never deleted completely. And you know, he said, you know, sure, come on board, we'll train you a little bit in some PR outreach. And that was the first. That's why I kind of stuck with PR and content ever since, 10 years now. It was this guy, Rinald Desai, who's the founder of the startup at the time, who was, you know, heavy into building relationships with journalists. And I didn't know any other way. I didn't know anything about PR. But the way he was approaching PR seemed really interesting, because what I heard about PR was, hey, there's this big list of journalists. And there's this PR release thing you make, and then you just email it to everybody. And then whoever opens it, reads it, and then if they are interested, they cover you. And if they're not, they just kind of delete it. And that's what I thought PR was until I met him, and he was talking about something completely different. He's saying, you got to build relationships with these journalists and bloggers and become their assistant, and then indebt them to a point where they ask you what you do. And I was thinking, wow, this is very different from doing a PR release on PR Newswire or sending out a PR release to a custom curated list of people, or hiring a PR firm to pay them $10,000 a month to have them place you in Forbes and Fast Company. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, wow, this is very different. So I kind of fell into it with him, and I was doing a lot of research for him essentially for like a year, just research on people. You know, what is this journalist like? What do they like to write about? What kind of data do they like to use in their articles? Do they have any spelling mistakes? Are they part of any trade organizations? Do they go to any networking events? I was doing all this research And it helped because I, you know, essentially saw the fruit of my research when he would reach out using this research. I guess I started forming my approach to marketing then with this like relationship-based approach to it.
That's great. A lot of people think of PR as being a broadcast, like you said, where you just spray and pray. You just put out as many messages as you can and hope that something works.
Yeah.
Versus Silicon Valley. I mean, you know, there's the blogs. It was probably TechCrunch was getting popular then. And there's all these other news sources. It's like, get to know these people. Fewer, higher quality relationships is better than having just hoping that somebody's going to pick you up.
Yeah. I mean, TechCrunch was the big big thing. I remember 2009. I mean, everybody was TechCrunch. It's kind of like Bitcoin Magazine or some of these Bitcoin CoinDesk and what are they called? Cointelegraph these days. Everybody's seeking to be published in these prestigious publications in the crypto space. TechCrunch was kind of like that back in the day, I remember. And I remember the first time I got into TechCrunch, it was amazing. It was like, my gosh, you know, it meant the world to the company. And yeah, not no longer like that. Things change. But it was really big back then. And then the financial crisis happened and things were, you know, I stayed in Silicon Valley for 6 years because of financial crisis. I mean, I could find a great job there, and moving back to the East Coast didn't make sense because there was nothing out here at the time for me to do. And I was into startups and marketing, and it was like our own little happy land over there. We're raising money, and money had it still kind of kept going. I don't know. It seemed like much less severe than on the East Coast of the States.
Yeah. So how was the transition? So you go through a few different startups and work with them. Some of them get acquired. And then you do this for 6 years, mm-hmm. developing your thesis, getting better at it, having, you know, more wins under your belt. What makes you decide to move back out to the East Coast and sort of pursue the path that you're on now?
We wanted to have kids eventually and move down to closer to home. But before we did that, what we did is we saved money for 2 years and went traveling around the world. So we had sold everything we had again. And we wanted to, we planned this crazy trip around the world for 6 months. And the idea was that I had gained enough knowledge or experience to be dangerous and maybe, you know, run things on my own. And I knew enough people because I started the speaker series. I became friends. You know, I interviewed Tim Ferriss and Matt Mullenweg from WordPress and Kevin Hartz from Eventbrite and Winklevoss Twins and, you know, lots of really well-known founders. And so I became really connected in Silicon Valley throughout my 6 years. And I knew a lot of marketers and brands and companies. I can certainly keep building those relationships, but I felt I wanted to be closer to family. And at the same time, we wanted kids, we wanted to settle down a bit. We had both gotten our graduate degrees. My wife was unhappy at her current job. She was working for a big corporation. And so, I mean, we planned it for 2 years. We planned this exit. We would save money. We lived in this crappy little studio apartment. And we'd be saving money off our every paycheck for this trip. And we had planned this crazy trip. And so we went on it and we sold everything we had. We went to Asia. And I think we started in Bangkok, finished in Marrakesh. And it was pretty cool. It was fun way to kind of disconnect from life and see a very different perspective from your everyday. And just, you know, there's more people out there not like us. So we wanted to see what the majority of population in this planet lives like, and you know, associate ourselves with them a bit more than what we're in day to day here in the States, kind of privileged a bit. And so so we did that, and then we came back and had kids and just settled on the East Coast. We're in New York now, but we're gonna move back to Boston, probably be closer to family.
Nice. I have a similar story. I've been traveling for the last 2.5 years myself. I was living in San Francisco and then threw everything into a storage unit and have been on the road ever since. And wow. So it's been pretty wild. I see what you're saying about the different perspectives, seeing how other people live, getting out of the bubble that you live in and everything like that. And, mm-hmm. but I can see where, as you travel, for me, at least, I've had a lot of think time, like time to think about what's next, what's the next move? What do I do? And, mm-hmm. and what's the thing that's going to give me fulfillment for the long haul, as opposed to, you know, when you're in the daily grind, it's like, how do I survive till tomorrow? Versus when you do this full-time travel, it's like, how mm-hmm. do you, like, what do you, like, what's the fulfillment going to be? And so what did you, like, when you got back, what do you decide to do?
Yeah, well, what I decided to do is start my own company, because right up until that point, when we started traveling, I was working for different companies and I, you know, had good success, and I changed my career from a software engineer to a marketer, and I liked what I was doing, but it wasn't my own business. I always wanted my own business, but I didn't know how to start it or how to run it. And there's just a lot of uncertainty with it. And so I did something kind of crazy, actually. So I had gotten back and I started throughout this whole travel experience, you know, we're going to Africa and Asia and everything. We're thinking about what we're going to do next. And we're doing meditation and yoga and having all these crazy experiences and hiking and everything. And so you're starting to think, like, what's my purpose in life? And how am I helping the world? And all the reading all these books. And, you know, I got back and I was like, all right, well, I really do want to do this marketing thing. I want to have my own business and I want to help people do what I know best, build relationships. And so I start my own consultancy, because back then I didn't have a real, like, I had an idea for a product. I didn't know about how to start it. And I never even thought about, you know, running just a product company, which I do now. But I started a consulting company, and there's a guy, Luke Rabluski, is a founder of Mobile First, and, you know, thought leader. He said, you know, to me, why don't you come on board as an employee or a marketer at my company? And we're starting it up. It's just me and my friend Jeff, and it's going to be this polling software company, and you can help us. And so I came on board, and in 2 years, this company went from 0 to 40 million page views. And I was using my PR techniques that I was kind of, I wrote a case study on it. If you Google my name and put Google, you'll see. But essentially, we were acquired by Google in 2 years. And the whole time I was scaling this company, I kind of knew that it was going to get acquired, because they were exploring it as a possibility. But I didn't join as a full-time employee. I was just, something in me kind of kept me away from pulling the plug. And I was like, oh, what am I doing? You know, we came back from this massive travel. We're settling down. We're going to have kids. This is like a holy grail here. This is the easiest money. I'll be able to just pay off like a whole, you know, half my house probably by the end of this thing. You know, you got to stay at Google for 4 years or whatnot. And maybe I'll stay there for 2 years. But, you know, something in me was just thinking, it's just too easy of a way out. And it still doesn't feel like I really should be building my own company. This is what I wanted to do during that travel. That's all I kept thinking. I need my own company. I want to build my own company. And by that point, I was very crystal clear in my mind. I wanted to build a PR software that helps you pitch journalists the right way, because I had seen so many years since 2007, I've seen how people do it the wrong way. And so I wanted to build a piece of software and a service that helps people do it the right way. And I just never did it. I never joined the company, and the company got acquired. And one day they all told me, you know, listen, like, this is what happened. Like, this is it. We're closing the doors. We're joining Google. And thanks for helping us, you know. You did a really good job, because I was the only marketer. And so the company left and they all went and joined Google. And everybody kind of was looking at me kind of like surprised, not too sure what to think of what I'm doing or what the heck is going on, or did something bad happen? Did we have a fight? And I was like, nope, I just decided not to join Google and walk my own way. And it was a great experience. And so after that, my son was born in 2014, and I had launched version one of my my tool called Just Reach Out. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible disaster. I mean, it was really bad. The code was written by a Pakistani developer, Hassan Mohammed, and he generated it from a tool that wasn't working at all, and nobody could edit it because it was auto-generated code. It was not human readable. And people were trying to use it. It was a disaster. Like, I was on a call with the insurance company trying to put my son on an insurance plan because he was just born. At the same time, I was on Skype chatting with this development team in Pakistan trying to get my site back up because there were people paying me to use it, and this thing wasn't working at all.
That's wild.
I know. It was kind of crazy. It was my first stab at building a company. I'm still with it today. It's been 3 years, and it's grown up a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm one of your customers, actually, or have been a customer.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, it's cool, the opportunities that you can find and you can go through everything. And I think that's part of entrepreneurship, right? To go and to make some mistakes or to try things and have them not work out. What clicked with you eventually that it started to come together? Was it user acquisition? Was it hiring better developers? How did you take it to the next step?
I mean, the product was not existing at all. I was doing marketing before the product was there. I read up all the lean startup methodologies there, and started just selling the product before it was built. Just trying to get people to pay me. And so I got way ahead of myself, and I sold the product that wasn't there and was kind of struggling to catch up. So I found a friend who kind of helped me for a bit, who was kind of part-time looking for a job between jobs. And he kind of patched my code up a lot to make it work the very least, like bare minimum version of it. It was still really sucky. It was falling down, and he had joined the company. He found himself a good job, and he just said, I can't really work on this anymore. And so I just looked around for a while, and then I partnered up with another friend of mine who runs a software development firm, and he really, his firm was really good, and we still work with them. It's been 3 years, but he's really helped me build the product, and it's been kind of a lonely ride. I've been doing things very non-traditionally, as I have been most of my life, I think. Like, I chose not to raise any money because I didn't know how to do it, and it seemed kind of slimy, and just I felt awkward in front of investors, and I didn't want to be good at raising money. And the whole thing seemed like a big, it just seemed pointless to me. I just wanted to build the product and try and sell it. So I didn't raise any money. Because of that, I didn't have a team for a while. So I was doing everything myself, which was not scalable at all, but I kept doing it and doing it and doing it. So I was doing product, I was doing lead gen, I was doing marketing, I was trying to do PR and SEO and ads and customer service. It was just everything myself. Complete nightmare for like a year and a half or so. But then we started earning some money. And I think last year was really when we started earning decent money where I could like hire a team of people. They're all remote. I have people from Philippines, from Kiev, from Bolivia, from Argentina, from Toronto, from Russia, from US also, all working on my product. And there's 10 of them now. And so still, like, the team is very remote, and they're all contractors, which is kind of wild still, because now we have 5,000 customers, and very, like, on any given day, about 1,000 that are very active with the service. And so it's a lot to kind of process. But we still don't have a typical office where you walk in, and there's, like, coffee, and there's, like, desks, and people are sitting down, and we have meetings. It's this wild Slack community group between us, and we're like all kind of running around like, what did this guy say? What did he say? What does he want? What's going on with this person? Yep. Still, there's a lot of madness to this business still. And so, I mean, it's growing. We're I think this year would be, I'm trying to set up some formal kind of like procedures and make things a bit more like a normal company. But it's still been kind of me up to until late last year, just running the show. We're getting to a point where I can hire some people to help me and improve it, basically improve the service, the offering. We now have managed service where we do PR outreach on your behalf. There's lots of different things to fix with it. But yeah, I think the software development firm was definitely helpful. And then getting the product actually to a point where, because I had built up this big image of it and had sold it to people, and then the product just was not working at all. Like, I did all the sales and marketing, and I was like, oh, I really need to build the product because these people paid for it.
Yeah, that's crazy. I think it happens more often than we think in business, but it also has to be pretty scary to say, hey, I'm selling this thing. We need to be able to deliver on it. And so obviously, I know the software, and it's just reach out, and it gives people, it helps them manage the opportunities they're looking after. And then you have your coaching program, you have your blog, you have a lot of things going on. How do you balance all these things?
Yeah, so that's funny. So it is kind of a wild ride. So I have a coaching program too to pay the bills. Not that just reach out doesn't pay the bills, but I usually don't take money out of the company. I try and keep it in the company. So to pay the bills, I have a coaching program, which one-on-one helps you learn how to do PR, kind of like everything I went to in one coaching program. And we have calls one-on-one. I teach you how to, you know, get in front of journalists, how to build relationships with them. And I usually try half and half. And sometimes it's three quarters of the day, just reach out, one quarter of the day, my coaching program. But it's essentially usually, yeah, half and half, where I try and spend, usually it's more time on just reach out. So I come in, usually I write up until 3 p.m. I'll work on just reach out. And then 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., that's when I either do interviews like this, or I'll do a coaching call where I'll coach some of my students who have signed up for my program, or I do some tasks around improving my coaching program, recording a new lesson, or I might improve the user experience of the website, or I might write some emails. But I used to be half and half with just consulting, so I used to be running the Just Reach Out service was half my day, and then at 12 noon or 1 p.m., I'd kind of shift over to consulting. I'd consult the client. I was lucky enough to make my course work in a way where it just kind of takes over, and it provides enough revenue to live off. And so I just run that mainly now. Sometimes I'll get a client, and then I'll just put the course in the back burner and really use the 3 to 5 or 2 to 5 p.m. Time frame to work on the core, on the client's consulting project. But usually, yeah, I try and bulk of the day. And that time for Just Reach Out is just, it's still, I don't have it down to a perfect science yet. I come in, and if there's a bunch of like complaints from customers or something crazy is happening, I need to like sell somebody on like a higher package, or, and I see like the folk, like people on my team are not like proactive enough answering. I'm always like fast. I have this fear of missing out all the time. And so I'm like, oh, the customer just contacted. They want to like this package. Why haven't we gotten back? Let me jump in. I just like get a call. And so my day kind of runs away from me a lot of times because I get sucked into that kind of like reactive mode.
Yeah, I hear that. So that's cool. I mean, do you have any tips that we can, that the audience can hear and share about building relationships? Is there like a killer thing, or is it more of just like the catalog of work and building a relationship, and then maybe like a relationship that you've built that like recently that uses that method?
Yeah, I was on Mixergy just the other day. I think they just published it yesterday, and Andrew Warner asked me the same question. He brought up a bunch of cool examples. He does a lot of research on like everything, but he asked me specifically, how did you build these relationships where, like, you got Tim Ferriss to interview Tim Ferriss and you got Ashton Kutcher to respond to your email? And how do you get into, you've published 1,400 articles. Like, how do you do this? This seems incredible and crazy to an average, you know, listener of my show. And I said, well, I didn't have any science or perfect process before I started doing this. So I just started experimenting with things. And I just quickly realized that it's just a person's need that you're trying to fulfill in building a relationship. So the first thing I always do, whenever you're sending an email to a journalist or an influencer or anybody who you want to build a relationship with, first of all, read it out loud. And that's the first, if you remember anything from this interview, just remember this. And this is towards, later stage in the interview here. But maybe we can, in the beginning, say there'll be a clip at 30 minutes into it. Dimitri's going to lay this down. Just remember this. When you send this email out, read it out loud. And when you read it out loud, imagine yourself standing in front of that person at a conference. And would you say that out loud to that person? That's the question you want to ask. If it is, then yes, great, send it along. If it's something that you kind of, maybe not, if there is a maybe in there, time to rewrite that email. There's something wrong with it that is not, it's kind of like me thinking joining Google. Joining Google would have been the right thing. I could have just sent that email to that person as well. But there's some kind of gut feeling inside. It's I don't know about this. It needs to be a little better. And so so that's one thing is you want to read that out loud and you want to make sure that it sounds right if you say it out loud to that person. How's that conversation going to continue? What is that person going to say back to you? So you've got to map that out in your head. What is that sequence of emails going to continue as? And your main reason for emailing anybody, if you're emailing your digital marketer, I don't know, maybe you want somebody to partner with you on a project. Maybe you want somebody to buy your service. Maybe you are emailing somebody you don't know and you just want to talk to them and demo a product to them. The main reason for you to email anybody is to indebt them to ask you how they can help you. So essentially, you want to promote, their doing, for example. A lot of times, I'm dying to have a journalist cover me. I'm dying to have somebody purchase my software. But when I reach out, I say, listen, I saw you wrote about X. I took your article and I answered this Quora question on Quora, and I referenced your article in that Quora question. And I'm not sure I did it justice, I don't think I really did it justice because there's some other answers in this Quora thread that are much more thorough than mine. Would you have more insight into this topic? And so this is a perfect way to start a conversation with somebody who is, somebody you don't know very well. Because you're already promoting them up front and you're giving them value up front. So it's almost genuine for them to, it's very genuine and it's very natural for them to respond to you. Those types, I think, initiative, that's what I would push people to remember and try is when you're doing any kind of, you're trying to convince somebody, you're trying to email somebody, because these days everything happens on email, a lot of stuff or initially. And so when you're doing any kind of emailing, A, would you read it out loud? Would you say it out loud to that person if you met them? And the second thing is, how can you indebt them?
Yeah, I think that's perfect, right? Because everybody, I think that most cold emails, and I get a lot of them, they're really boring. And they, if you just replaced the word of their company, you could just say, Dear Jeff, me. And then it's asking for something. That's almost every email that I get. And I just delete them because I don't care about them and they haven't really proven the value. They haven't given me a reason to. And they're putting all the burden onto me to then react to it, to respond to it, to do something about it. Here's a link to a YouTube video. Watch that and then get back to me. Or let me know when you're available. Those are all painful calls to action that I receive from people all the time versus the good ones. They express some kind of empathy as to what I'm going through or what's going on, and they try to solve problems. Like it should be, dear Jeff, you, right? And I think that's a lot of what you're talking about here is saying, I did something of value to you, and are you interested in that? Not only that, but also, like you said, make it conversational, that if you said this out loud to somebody, how would they look at you? How would they treat you? Would they say, oh, that's a no-brainer? Or would they say, I'm not really sure about what this person is telling me?
Yeah. It's just like one-to-one conversation. Imagine yourself talking to them live at a conference. How can you make an impression on them outside of everyone else trying to talk to them?
Yeah. And rarely do we, in a conversation, do we try to sell them in person? Like, you would never do that, right? You would, like, the relationship is not transactional when you meet somebody in person. It's usually a conversation, feel them out, get to know them a little bit, and then see if there's any opportunity, and then go for the opportunity. You know, you need some kind of dialogue back and forth.
You need to just think through that whole back and forth, basically. How is that funnel going to look with those email exchanges? How are you going to keep offering them value? How can you just... And I talk about that in my course a lot. My first lesson is how to strike up a personalized conversation starter. And these conversation starters are very different one-to-one, but like a lot of them are starting out this very way. Like, you're promoting them, or you're asking for a quote for an article you're writing, or... A really quick one, actually, is answering Harrow, a helper reporter. There is lots of different versions of that throughout the world. Essentially, journalists every day put out queries for experts to interview in their articles. And they need these experts rather quick because they're writing an article. Say they're writing an article about entrepreneurship, or maybe they're writing an article about digital marketing. They just need an expert to talk about predictions for 2018. And they need a quote. That's all they need. And so you can actually respond to those journalists and do them a favor and maybe get promotion almost right away. It's a rare opportunity, but it's the easiest, kind of lowest hanging fruit.
Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of people do. I haven't had the greatest success with Harrow before, but I'm guessing that you have some tips for that too. Like, how do you do it? So is it using the same strategy then as basically just solving a problem for them? Is it, you know, I think my response is usually literal. It's like, I see a request, then I'll be like, I do that. Do you want to talk to me? But I think that you can probably do a lot better job than just saying yes. You have to give them some kind of angle back to it, right?
A lot of times you're trying to find the best fit there, and you're trying to figure out, what can I say that a typical answer won't say? Because what happens is you always have to figure out what their end of the email conversation looks like and what their inbox looks like when you're corresponding with somebody. And that's, a lot of times we don't think that way. We think about quantity. We're thinking 100 people I'll email and I'll get 2 responses. We're always thinking about numbers. But it's not so much numbers, it's about quality. Like, when you're responding to that journalist, how many responses do you think that journalist got from that posting? Maybe they got 100, maybe they got 50. And what do you think they're talking about? Like, how quick do you think those people wrote those responses? How quickly can they, how long did it take them? How quality of a response was that? So you want to say something that's very staggering, very different, very surprising, and that also hits upon a value point that journalist cares a lot about. So you might want to look through and see who that journalist is, what have they covered before. And when you reach back out, make it personal. Make it say, hey, Susan, I actually read one of your past articles 2 weeks ago about the, you know, this and the other, and this answer actually is going to reference that article, you know? And, you know, journalists love that. You know, if you've read their article, not only have you read their article, you're going to be referencing it in your answer to a query that they need. That's one way to stand out. You know, it's if you're courting somebody, you want to be the best that your partner has ever had. So you're trying to impress them the most. And so you're trying to think of an amazing activity you guys can do together, or you can surprise them somehow, make a present for them, or surprise trip somewhere. You're always trying to figure out a way to, you know, surprise them and also build an engaging kind of relationship. Same kind of thing here, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that seems like an obvious answer, but I think that a lot of times even responding to a inquiry on Haro or just anything is a me. And so I guess that makes a lot of sense when you think about it, is that my response has been a me. Same thing I just complained about when it comes to people cold outreaching me. Now, I guess I might have just assumed that if somebody's inquiring about needing something, that they that you just need to say, I have this need. But it doesn't seem like it's like that at all. It's basically saying, not only do I have the need, but I'm solving the problem for you, right? It's like you are solving their issue. And that is that they are so desperate. Maybe not desperate's not the right word, but they're so urgently in need of somebody with expertise that they would put it out there and just take any answer from anybody on that service. And so you need to look at it that way, is that they're going to choose the one that makes their life easier, like that makes it immediately easier. And if you just say, hey, I can answer that, then they're not going to choose you, because it's actually creating more work for them as opposed to solving the problem for them.
Yeah. You want somebody who... You just want to keep solving problems for them or be of value somehow. Sometimes, like, it's really hard. And I go the quicker approach, like, spell check their articles. You might find mistakes in their articles or publications or whatnot, whatever they're putting out. And catch that. Fact check their articles. Maybe they need more data in them. Send them notes about that. Just become their assistant. Like, Murnau has always taught me, is any way you can provide value to a journalist is usually a good way. Strike up a crazy conversation in their comments on their article. Like, nobody does that these days. A lot of people just tweet or whatnot.
You just got to stand out, right? You got to stand out.
Yeah, just want to stand out any way you can. And I don't have a specific process always in place. I'm trying to stand out any way I can. To like for Ashton Kutcher, it took me 12 months to get everybody who he has mentioned on Twitter on a speaker series that I ran. So I would follow him and I'd see, oh, anybody who's an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley has he mentioned. I would record them and put them down on a big list. And essentially, I try and interview every single one of them. So after a year of interviewing everyone, I reached out and I said, listen, I've interviewed everybody you've mentioned but you, and I'd love to interview you. And he responded. He never like committed. I never interviewed him, but I still have a connection to his assistant, which is cool. But it took me a year.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes a lot of sense, right? Is that this is because of the nature of solving somebody's problem, there's no perfect formula that works every single time. But what works is making their lives easier and standing out from the crowd. You know, you have to assume that the numbers are stacked against you. That if one person sees it, 1,000 people see it, and you need to be the one that immediately rises to the top as like this solves a problem. So solving it fast and solving it effectively seems to be the common point in all of this.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I think I've learned a good amount about this, and actually I think I could change my approach just from these few tips that you have. And I think that just understanding where you're coming from is going to be really helpful for everybody. Is there any other things that you wanted to share about your business or about what you're doing and where people can find you?
Find me at justreachout.io. That's my 3/4 of my day-to-day and weekends sometimes. Justreachout.io is my tool, my service, PR service. And then my blog is criminally prolific. So prolific, it's criminal. My wife named the blog back in 2012, criminallyprolific.com, where I post experiments, anything that I'm working on, kind of pretty long form SEO optimized content. But yeah, those are the two URLs. And I'd love to hear from you. You know, if you're listening to this thinking, I don't know what to email this guy. Just send me a note. Say, listen to your interview. Loved it. Here's what I'm doing. I love to just hear from people who might email subscribe. You know, if somebody logs in, subscribes to my blog, I say the first thing I say to them, thank you for subscribing. You join 20,000 other folks. And the first thing I want to know is, what are you struggling with? Or what are you working on? And if it's, even if it's teeny tiny, if you're struggling something teeny tiny, I want to know about it. And I get all sorts of awesome answers, you know. The other day I had, oh, this was crazy. This woman in New Zealand, she's 75 years old. She made a career of, she was selling wedding dresses. And she was searching for spiritual quotes. This is like outside of Auckland, New Zealand, some like little shack of a place. It's like a village. And she bumped into one of my blog posts. I have a blog post about meaningful email endings. So somehow that got optimized for the word spiritual quotes or something. And so she bumped in. She subscribes to it. And I'm like, oh, hi, Ruth. You know, what do you do? And she says, I am a community patrol for our village here in New Zealand. But I made a career of making wedding dresses. And I'm 75. And I'm getting into online marketing. I'm like, whoa, really? She's like, not really, but your blog has inspired me. And I'm like, well, what are you struggling with? She's like, struggling understanding this whole thing. So yeah, it's fun to just hear from people who listen to you.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's a good point is that if somebody is interested in this, they know how to find you and they can even try to use some of these tactics. Cause it sounds like if it's effective, then you'll get back to them and it's something that they'll find interesting. And so, yeah, that's a great way to get in touch with Dimitri is to sign up for his mailing list at criminallyprolific.com. Yeah,
please do.
Awesome. This is really cool. This is really awesome to hear your tips and something that I think, like I said, I could apply right away. And I think that it's something that I'm going to tell people about. Maybe I'll even send them your link whenever they send me a poor outreach email. I'll be like, hey, you need to solve my problem. You need to do something that stands out. You're generic. And it's all about you. What you should do is make it all about
me. Yeah, do it. Send them my way and ask, you know, if anybody wants any help with any of that stuff, ask them.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing about the good news that comes through this interview. And I look forward to being CC'd on some of the outreach that people do when they talk to you. So thanks for joining me, Dimitri.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That was a fun story. It was cool to hear Dimitri's origin story and even know how he came up with the name Criminally Prolific. I was also impressed by the length Dimitri will go to in order to form a relationship with journalists. He'll reach out to them, he'll read their articles, and he'll provide value. All in an effort to stand out from the crowd. That's what it takes to succeed in the world of PR. And Dimitri provides great examples and inspiration of how you can get things done. Thanks for joining me, Dimitri, and sharing some of your secrets. For show notes, visit jefflytics.com/Dimitri.